This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
The goal of this podcast since day one is to provide the best information on the Vancouver real estate market at no cost to you, the listeners. To that end, we'd like to thank the following sponsors.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it also is making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
We want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Elmwood, a 38-story tower located at Burquitlam's most important intersection, Como Lake Avenue and Clark Road. This landmark tower will feature 335 condominiums, over 37,000 square feet of office and retail space, and almost 20,000 square feet of amenity space. Elmwood has been incredibly popular with 80% sold currently, but they still have a great selection of junior one-bedroom all the way to three-bedroom homes remaining. Check out marcon.ca/elmwood for more.
And Matt, we are also excited about Soane House, Marcon's newest community in West Coquitlam, with 165 homes ranging from junior one beds to three beds. Soane House offers the perfect West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced Nordic-inspired design. Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's S-O-E-N-H-A-U-S. Or you can learn more at marcon.ca or follow them at Instagram at Marcon Homes.
Marcon, building for life.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, today we've got a phenomenal episode on this resilient podcast, which is about resilience.
We are resilient. I used to call us an upstart. I guess that's no longer the case. I feel like we're almost at the retirement phase.
Yeah, we're in the free fall position here. With no shoot. It's definitely not an upstart podcast. I actually was looking at somebody. We've actually got a few new reviews on our podcast recently, which I was reading, as I always do. And I noticed that we are now almost at the 5-year mark.
Wow. That is resilience.
Yeah, I know. We're just a couple fresh-faced Scalinas on this when we first started this thing. And now we're both,
10 pounds heavier than I was 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
A few more gray hairs.
Yeah. You know, this thing, I'm glad we've contributed to flattening the curve, but we haven't flattened anything on me.
You know what? This is, I was just thinking of tips. Anyone right. who works out is probably familiar with Strava. This is something that I think I'm not saying anything that's new to anyone except me. Right. I just downloaded Strava. This app it's going to change my life. I'm jogging outside. I'm competing with some guys I know. So if you want to compete on short runs, look me up on Strava. That's my tip this week. It's going to change my life. It hasn't yet, but I got big plans.
You know, I was just thinking about, because you're running holding your like iPhone Plus, which seems kind of crazy. You should probably get an Apple Watch, or you should maybe, I don't know if they have another tracker, maybe somebody has a tip for you, but there's probably a Garmin out there or something that you can run with. Isn't it uncomfortable holding your phone?
No, you know what? It's actually not bad. I'm also one of those guys that plays music without earphones in. So when I run by you, I got tinny music coming from my iPhone.
You're listening to music on your run?
I'm like the guy on the bike flaring.
Yeah, but the guy on the bike has speakers coming out of his backpack. You're just...
No, mine's out of a tinny iPhone.
Wow. That's you're annoying. That's
really really stepping up my game here. But Adam, we're kind of getting off track here. We brought up resilience and how resilient we are in the podcast is and right. Strava and everything else, because we have Jeb Brugman on the show today. Jeb Brugman is a leading practitioner and thinker on strategy and procession of innovation in the urban planning sphere. He's the founder and principal of Resilient Cities Catalyst. And he does keynotes all over the place, but really what his work focuses on right now is looking at the 21st century, and especially in contrast to the 20th century, in the last half of the 20th century, where stability reigned, right?
Yes.
We're still in the early stages of the 21st century, but we've had a number of crises, I guess, starting since September 11th, where Jeb's making the case that there's a lot more to come. We're in the dress rehearsal stage for a lot of upheaval here, and he's strategizing on how cities can become stronger in the face of all the upheaval that we're seeing this century.
Yeah, man, and it does remind me of our podcast, Becoming Stronger in the Face of Adversity, but on a side note, his work is recognized by the UN. It's supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. And Matt, you'll know the Rockefeller Foundation from the play on words of Rockefeller Records. Yeah. But no, in all seriousness, though, this is a phenomenal conversation. Jeb is a fantastic guest. I can't wait for that. But Matt, of course, we are sponsored by Oakland Realty. So shout out to Oakland Realty. And if you are a new agent or somebody considering making a move, an agent making a move, I would suggest. Yeah, you got to check. I would definitely check out oakwin.com/join.
So Adam, what you want to do is you want to head to oakwin.com/join and type in VRP 2020. That's not VREP, although if you put that in,
nobody knows sure what will happen.
Sure. Yeah. But don't try it. Put in VRP 2020. You get a free mystery gift, and you get to learn about what I would say, hands down, is the best brokerage in the Lower Mainland.
Yeah.
So this mystery gift is great. Don't get me wrong, but you get a lot more out of Oakland than this free mystery gift.
You know what? You call it a mystery gift. I call it a great big surprise. And I have no idea what it is, but I know it's a surprise, and it's going to be one that you're going to want to get. So head over to oakwin.com/join and sign up there, VRP 2020. And Matt, without further ado, let's cut to our interview with Jeb Brugman.
Absolutely. This is a phenomenal conversation. I think everyone's going to enjoy this one.
Okay, so we're here with Jeb Brugman, founding principal at Resilient Cities Catalyst. How are you doing, Jeb?
Very good, Adam. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. And thanks for taking the time.
That's great. And Matt, I should say hello to you too. I guess we're all three together, aren't we?
That's right. Yeah. Good to see you, Jeb. Maybe can we start, Jeb, by you telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and about Resilient Cities Catalyst?
Yeah, sure. So people in Vancouver would know me as a person who started a large international organization of city governments. It's called ICLEI, Local Governments for Sustainability. We started in the late 80s, early 90s, the whole field of urban sustainability, of cities taking on climate change, greenhouse gas mitigation. And Vancouver has, of course, always been, and Metro Vancouver as well, the regional government and municipalities have been a big leader in that space for many decades as well. So I started that organization and built it to be hundreds of cities around the world. It's now more than 1,000 cities involved in that. Then got involved in business innovation, focusing on products, working with some of the world's largest companies on new products to address poverty conditions in developing countries. And then got into this field of resilience largely because I was working with low-income communities around the world who are the most vulnerable in the face of shocks that we're familiar with, hurricanes, floods, and things of that nature. But now we have a couple of bizarre ones that have hit our continent in the last decade, the global financial crisis and now a pandemic. So we've been really trying to figure out what urban resilience is and how it is that we can use the occasions of shock events like the one we're suffering now to understand where the vulnerability is and then make investments as we recover in a way that you build a more resilient condition, because it's not the last one we're going to be hit with.
Is there, just thinking about the idea of urban resilience, is it, presumably it's an ongoing project to kind of better the lives of people, but is there something about, like, are we facing more kind of economic shocks now than we did in the past? Like, is this a more important project than ever right now?
Well, I think we've come out of a period since economies have stabilized after World War II of tremendous stability. I mean, we take for granted the stability of the decades that we've lived our lives in. And it's not just been economic stability relatively, but it's been political, institutional stability, the global world order that was constructed to come out of World War II and the Great Depression has lasted most of our lives. Right. And we've had environmental stability. So climate was predictable. Insurance companies could write policies to protect you from 100-year storm events. Well, in 10 years, there's going to be events that fall off of that actuarial curve. So now we're in an era where there's tremendous unpredictability. Some of it is creative. We've got technology change accelerating tremendously. There are creative aspects of globalization and the way we've rearticulated global production and supply chains. But all of those things create, yet still not fully known, vulnerabilities. You know, you put new systems in place and create new interdependencies, and sooner or later you discover what the vulnerabilities are. And so I think we are, because climate is changing, because we're in a globally interconnected economy like we haven't been. There's political forces that are unwinding the institutional order that's provided us with political and sort of social stability. So we'll have more shock events, and then we have more vulnerabilities that those shock events ripple through. So if I like to use the analogy, as I have in a paper I've written, of a fault line, something that Vancouverites are familiar with. It, you know, the stress that builds up there leads to a shock event, and then it ripples in all kinds of ways, including through the structures of the buildings that have been built over the last century and many other vulnerabilities that, you know, regions exposed to those kinds of events are unfamiliar with, economic ones as well. So that's what we're up against. And as we come out of COVID-19, which we will, we have to understand what made our economy most fragile. And how do we need to create a new infrastructure of supports and institutions in order to be in a position to not be taken off guard by the next shock that comes at us that way?
Jeb, I'm just thinking, why is it so important to look at the municipality level?
So in a way, cities and municipalities were just, in my career, it was a horse I selected back in the 1980s. When I started working with city governments, at that time mostly in the United States, because the problems that were emerging in the world, refugee crises, you know, early signals of global climate crisis, other environmental problems, that back then it was the ozone layer depletion, the effects of all these things were showing up in our cities. And it was at a time, so people have been urbanizing in the world since, at a rapid rate since the 1950s. And so trend lines were very clear that the world's population and therefore the world's economy and the world's sources of pollution, because production, was all going to end up more and more concentrating in cities. And it wasn't until the decade of the 2000s that, I put it a bit tongue-in-cheek this way, that the world discovered the existence of cities. So we started hearing about half the world's people living in cities and megacities, but it was very clear back in the 70s and 80s that this is how the world was going to be organizing itself. And so these days, not only are the majority of people living in cities, but that global economy we refer to in very abstract terms, it is an economy that's structured in supply chains that go city to city to city. The Port of Vancouver is a critical infrastructure, not just for Canada, right? It's a critical infrastructure for North America's economy. And so it was important to me as I got more involved with global environmental issues in the 1980s and reached out to the United Nations at that time, the UN Environment Program, to figure out what, you know, what could be done at this sort of more grassroots level, is to figure out how we create relationships between municipality, city governments, and national and international governments, so that when you negotiate a climate agreement, it's very clear how that has to trickle down to what cities need to do to deal with their energy efficiency, with their fuel sources, all those things that are essential for achieving anything on a global scale.
Well, maybe thinking at both the local city level in Canada and I guess North America, but also at the national level, just taking a step back, Jeb, what are your thoughts on how Canada has fared so far in facing the COVID-19 challenge?
But the first thing I'd say about Canada is that the leadership of Canada, I mean, there is an institutional stability here, a political one, that we're not seeing south of the 49th. And it's very stark, remarkably so. So you see across the parties that they are aligning around a common program. And of course, you know, every party in the minority has to have an alternative thing that they say they would do. But I'm being here in Ontario, we're seeing a tremendous cooperation between the progressive conservative government and even the New Democratic Party around what needs to happen. So that says a lot about for Canada. In terms of the response measures to deal with the economic shock, again, it's a tremendous contrast that the federal government here understands that it's efficient and productive for the economy to not put the burden on businesses to have to lay off their workforces, throw people out into an unemployment pool, which then falls on the public purse. And then those people have to find their way back into an economy, and businesses, especially small businesses, have to figure out how to restaff up. So if you want to have an efficient recovery as much as you can after a crisis of this nature, keeping people on salary, on payroll, is both better for the people and is better for the business. And then the other aspect that is related to that, of course, is the focus on small business. And the Americans are still working on figuring, coming to understanding that the foundation of their economy is still small business in a world that's enamored to Silicon Valley and everything of that nature, and Boeing. aerospace, as another example, that will get a bailout. But focusing on the foundation of the small business sector in Canada and the U.S. is fundamental. That is our resilience. And small business is not only the source of that resilience because it employs so many people. It is the engine of new job creation. It is often the engine of innovation as well. But it's because that's where people go. Not only to get their groceries, but it's where they go and they meet their neighbors. It's where small businesses are known to help out, whether it's to support the hockey league in the best of times, or whether it's to deliver groceries to people who are homebound in the worst of times. So I feel extremely positive about the way the Canada has responded, especially particularly in contrast to the United States and some other countries.
Yeah, it's funny.
The president of Brazil is still denying that COVID is even a problem, so it could be much worse.
You know, it's funny when you think about Justin Trudeau, whether you like him or not, he has some foils that he can kind of point to around the world to make him look pretty. He looks like quite the statesman right now.
Yeah, that's quite true. But, you know, I'll tell you, Premier Ford is looking like quite the statesman right now, too.
Right.
I mean, people have risen to this place of political leadership. In the United States, we have this contrast of Governor Cuomo, who, you know, compared with President Trump, just shows up as the kind of presence of leadership that we need. And I think we've got a better supply of it here.
So you've talked, you've kind of briefly mentioned small business as part of, as a fundamental component to this idea of the resilient economy. Maybe can we talk a little bit more about what a resilient economy coming out of COVID-19 actually, like, what does it actually look like? What is it? What are the steps we need to put into place?
So every city in any case, or every regional government needs to look at where the biggest cascading failure has shown up. And we won't really, the cascading is only just beginning, right? So yes, businesses are closed, and now we have businesses that aren't paying their rents, and that's going to impact people who have invested in property. It's going to impact the way property finance might continue after the fact. We don't know what's going to happen to the restaurant business if you're in commercial real estate, or even if you're in mixed use real estate, and you've got a ground floor where it's typically restaurants and cafes and things like that. How is this experience going to change not only what people, how much they show up at the restaurant, the cafe again, after they've gotten better coffee makers sent to them by Amazon during the crisis itself, whatever. But, you know, in what ways are restaurants going to have to, buffer themselves in the future to shock events of this nature? So there's all kinds of cascading effects. And I was just on a call with U.S. colleagues today that no one really has the answer. We're all on a learning curve to figure out where those vulnerabilities at the end of the day prove to be greatest. I think that where it's clear among all of us that the small business world has only begun to see the extent of shocks, as you're very familiar with, and particularly in the United States as well. Small business has already been suffering tremendously vis-a-vis online retail and the global supply chains that online retail provides. In prime locations in cities, small business rents are very high, so that's another pressure on them. And then small business people oftentimes don't have good business continuity planning. They're not companies, they're sole proprietorships, there's all kinds of family issues. The whole sector, I think, deserves a look as to how we can help small business people understand their vulnerabilities, how to build business continuity plans, and think not just how to recover from this crisis, but long term, how they're going to secure the asset that is their small business and take it through the life cycle of operations until they pass it on to their children or sell it, whatever the case may be. And that's something that the real estate sector has a tremendous, there's an interdependency there, right? So small business is an ecosystem that includes the property side, that includes the proprietor and the supplier to the proprietor, and it includes all the households in that market catchment area. And that's why I anchor my argument on the recovery that we need to renew this concept that is, still very current in the Greater Vancouver area of complete communities. We need to understand that small business is part of a node of commercial and social life. And that as residents change, as there's succession and demographics within neighborhoods, the small business community has to be supported to go along with that. There shouldn't be a 10-year lag between there being, I live in the old Greek community of Toronto. It's actually been a 20 or 30 year lag between this old Greek small businesses who kept selling things to an older Greek population demographic that had long moved to the suburbs north of Toronto, and a younger demographic or a, downtown Bay Street more oriented demographic that wanted to buy other things. And so I think, how do we support small businesses to make the adjustments, to have the kind of market data, the market research that large companies have that allow them to be productive and competitive in the world? That'll be a big piece of it.
So if I understand, and I think we were talking earlier about, there's a journalist here, Frances Beulah, who writes for the Globe and Mail and others. Mm-hmm. And she said, she made a point on Twitter, think about who you're supporting during this lockdown, because the world that you emerge, when you emerge back into the world, that's going to have an impact on what the world looks like. And I think it was a really kind of smart way of framing it. Mm-hmm. But in terms of how do we make a cultural shift, right? Because like in the paper that we read of yours, you're talking about, the multiplier effect of money in a local community, and when money stays in the community as opposed to goes to Amazon or wherever, at a moment in which there is you know, people are worried about their mortgages, people are worried about their rent, people are going into presumably further debt. Like, how do we make that shift to maybe not the race to the bottom of the Walmart kind of model to a more kind of local, sustainable model that you're talking about?
Yeah, so the reason I call that model an infrastructure that we're building is that, look, Walmart and Amazon's, they're optimizing value for consumers tremendously. That's why, you know, I've worked on with Main Street small business communities and transitioning communities and lower income communities, and have done the customer surveys of the erstwhile, the former customers of these small Main Street businesses. And it's amazing the extent to which people, even low income people, both because it's of the experience and the aspiration, and also of the price and the quality and the choice that's available when they go to a shopping mall or they go to Amazon. So obviously there's value that's created there, but that value doesn't provide the infrastructure that a society needs to get through a shock. And that infrastructure is a place where there's social cohesion and social relationships and a kind of community service orientation. And that's where small business has always played. And I guess the question is then, how can we economically better recognize that value that is beyond the value of the milk that I can pick up there?
Right.
Or, you know, whatever it is, the better coffee I can get down the street at this, at the small business cafe, that is a value that they serve as kind of a community infrastructure. I mentioned cafe. There's a cafe pub in my neighborhood that I refer to, and many people do now, as our community, it's our neighborhood living room. It's where we meet each other. There are people who work there. It's where all generations meet up there. And it's very typical of the kind of small business life you'll see in European cities that we all love to go to in the summertime for our holidays, where, you know, multi-generational people are always mixing and out in the square on a weekend night. So there's that dynamic in our cities here in Canada as well. And so to get directly to your point, if we're going to economically value that infrastructure that's there, that stabilizes neighborhoods and provides service in the face of crisis, we need to make sure that there are established backup funds for those businesses in the instance of future shocks. And there's a wonderful paper that's been put out by Bruce Katz, one of the leading urban policy thinkers in the United States, around these what's called local relief funds. So more and more cities have been setting up using public sector funding, charitable money, and some private sector contributions, rainy day funds to support small business communities in the instances of shocks, and also through major transitions that happen in those areas. So that's something that we didn't think was a necessary ingredient of having a good local economy, that I think we do need to think about for this century, in the century of shocks. We also have to, you mentioned the local money multiplier. It's been kind of a French thing, this idea of, they call them alternative currencies, but they're the better word that's used these days is complementary currencies. So how do we, just like neighborhood institutions and churches and YMCAs become a place where people can provide support and have yard sales and barter services to one another, complementary service currencies are a way that you can sort of sign up and become a dedicated customer to your village small business ecosystem. And these are cropping up more and more. And we started working within Resilient Cities Catalyst with one that is now supported by a venture capital firm. So there are now for-profit local currency creation companies. This one's called Kolu, C-O-L-U. And they have an added value feature in that they not only create this currency that allows people to get a Kolu coin in exchange for providing services, or to buy coins so that they can, you know, shop locally and support local businesses, but also the city can contribute coin to local citizens who participate as volunteers in implementing city programs and initiatives. So in a way, what the complementary currency does is it says value is how we support one another and volunteer for one another, and value is what we buy and make for one another. And that's the infrastructure that allows a local economy to function. And what the Amazon world does is says value is the right price point and the convenience of the shop, but it's not about all that other social stuff that we need to get by. And so it's recognizing the value of the social component that's especially important when we're going through a crisis.
I feel like I'm asking all the questions here, but I got a couple more, Adam, but do you want to?
No, go ahead.
I was just thinking, so, I mean, in your paper, you focus on kind of areas that have faced deindustrialization, kind of more depressed communities. Vancouver is obviously, I think there's some similarities across all communities here, especially with levels of debt and potentially stagnant wages in certain sectors, that type of thing. But we're definitely in I wouldn't put us in the same league, but it seems like to me, going on what you just said, like that, it's almost like a hollowing out of that local thriving community in certain areas that I don't think we've seen in places like Vancouver. Can you maybe speak to the differences between, say, the Hamiltons, not to single out any community, and I think Hamilton's doing quite well right now, is my understanding, but the Hamiltons of the world or the Reginas versus the Vancouvers or the Torontos?
Yeah, so Vancouver has a very different set of stresses, absolutely right. Of course, Vancouver went through a cycle of having to remediate brownfield sites and to replace declining industries in the resource sector and build up its service economy. And it's come through that, and then it got some help from a country called China in terms of investment flows coming in. But it's done a lot to pull itself up too, in all due credit, including to the property sector in Vancouver. But the stress, I haven't studied all of the latest socioeconomic stresses in Vancouver, but one that is common with the United States is the current newly forming households, the younger generation, are incredibly stressed out by the declining affordability of housing and just living in general in Vancouver. And so having just looked at the U.S. numbers, you know, among the demographic in their 20s, most are in debt. And in the 30s, they have marginal savings. Very marginal savings.
I saw so just in this the on in your paper it was $7,500 I think the average 30-year-old has, and the in the early 20s it's potentially negative.
It's zero to negative in the 20s.
And incredible.
And yeah. This was just looking at this segment of the economy. So in my paper, what I do is look at moderate to lower income households and really explore how much of the U.S. gross domestic product are those households accountable for. So these are American households that, you know, all the members together earn less than $70,000 a year. So average adult income of $35,000 a year. It's not a great income, right? So moderate to low. They account for 27% of gross domestic product in the United States. Business investment accounts for 18%. All business investment in the United States accounts for 18% of the gross domestic product. So if we're not paying attention to these moderate to lower income households and understanding what new stresses are coming on them, we are not prepared for the shocks that result in sudden losses in household wealth or losses in household income, just like in the global financial crisis in the last decade. So one of the stress points in the greater Vancouver area is, of course, the newly forming households, which, of course, are in tremendous concern for the housing sector. Who is the real estate sector going to be building households for and trying to sell households to when your emerging demographic that is going to become your majority within 10 to 20 years has such a poor balance sheet? So that would be a particularity to look at, and figuring out how do you design neighborhoods? How do you design street level commercial spaces and houses themselves for this new gig economy work life, where more and more people are working from home, working remotely, becomes another issue as well. So that I'm sure the property sector, and you've got some very innovative developers there in the Vancouver area, is really tracking these demographics and trying to figure out what it's going to demand of them. But you could look at that. We also have an aging population in Vancouver and all Canadian cities. It's at the other end of that spectrum that has a fixed income that doesn't have many solutions to deal with any kind of economic shock.
Do you think, just thinking kind of more broadly, we've been talking a little bit on the program about the rise of nationalism, the seeming push away from kind of the last 30, 40 years of kind of cosmopolitanism and globalization. Do you see what you guys are talking about kind of really focusing in on small business and local economies as kind of, part of a larger move away from globalization?
No, I don't. I see it as I think all of the policy focus has been on fair trade and globalization and liberalization of markets, and so we've shifted tremendous resources in favor of that segment of our national economies, and have ignored the importance of what isn't so sexy but is, in many respects, more essential, which is the ground level economies within our cities and neighborhoods. So I just think this is a prime moment to sort of re-elevate the centrality of that. It's staring us in our faces today. And I started writing and speaking about this when in the United States, the first support package was being debated in the US Senate, and big numbers were already being cast about how Boeing was going to get a substantial bailout. And at that time, there was nothing being talked about for the small business community. I mean, an adjustment's been made there, but our experience in 2008, 2009, 2010 in the global financial crisis is that the large corporate sector is what got the too big to fail companies got most of the attention. And when it came to households and household bankruptcy and mortgage defaults, there is nothing but really an awkward solution offered to help them recover. And for that reason, we have still a declining home ownership rate, probably in Canada and the United States. And people haven't really recovered from the debt load that they ended up having once when their household equity collapsed in the financial crisis. So this time we have to make up for what we ignored the last time.
Do you think that the financial stimulus from the Liberal government for small business has been sufficient?
See, this is where I think we're going to be learning just how much of a shock, how much does this ripple down into different components. The small business sector is a many-headed beast, obviously. Which of the subsectors within that are going to be hurt the most? And I kind of feel like asking you guys, because you're at the ground level and your constituents are in the commercial property space and are property owners. Like, what's being felt among property owners in Vancouver as people are being told that they can't pay their rents? And is there a sense that this is just a couple of months of loss that they have to absorb? Or are they actually starting to talk about significant long-term vacancies that they're going to have to contend with?
There seems to be a lot contingent on a potential second wave and, moving back into isolation in the fourth quarter. That concerns people, right? Because, I mean, if at least in Vancouver, I feel the sense that people are anticipating that it could be kind of May, June, that the economy starts to come back. Obviously not at full speed, but people starting to get back to business, not quite as usual, but to some extent. But it could be, I think, quite crippling if we hit a second wave in the fall And, you know, it's months over months of people remaining in isolation, I would imagine. At least that's what I get from talking to people in the commercial space.
And is there a sense that there will be a decline in value and balance sheet value of commercial properties as a result of this? Is this just an income statement problem, or is there a fear that there will be some deflation in the property market there, in the commercial property market in particular?
Well, you know, so Adam and I both work in residential. We just had somebody on who owns a commercial brokerage. And I mean, that was my sense that, you know, he was talking about kind of a new normal where instead of, you know, 100 people at tables in the small restaurant that pays it very high rents to operate in Yale Town or wherever they do here in Vancouver, that the model, at least for the next couple of years, is going to shift to kind of not as many people dining at the same time or interested in dining at the same time, and then the kind of ripple effects through that market. What we've talked about more than anything is, you know, and I think it's interesting because Vancouver is so service oriented, right? Like the cruise ship industry brings in the summer millions of dollars a week into the economy, right? So if that's not here, and the tourism goes away, like what does this actually look like, right? It's pretty terrifying, because I think even if, at least my understanding from where we are in Vancouver, is we're doing quite well in relation to a lot of other places, and we've really kind of planked the curve or flattened the curve, however you want to say it. Mm-hmm. But what that looks like, I think the kind of quasi business as usual is, you know, hopefully we can have people in our backyard to have a drink, like not necessarily that we're going back to a crowded bar or concert or anything anytime soon. And especially with international travel, I think that's not on the table for the time being. So I'd imagine it's going to have some pretty massive effects here.
Yeah. So tourism, conference business, your hotel business. I mean, that itself, when you come to the question, is the federal government money going to be enough? That's a sector that's probably going to suffer for a longer period of time. The local restaurants, they can spread tables out more. They can also do delivery. So I think we're going to see more and more innovation in sort of localized delivery services. I have lived in New York City for the preceding 3 years, and it's amazing the extent to which bicycle food delivery has taken over. Of course, it's Manhattan, but and very dense. But one can envision some solutions for the restaurateurs who serve that local consumer market catchment. But the ones that are down on the waterfront that are serving the tourists are going to be much, much harder hit. Yeah. Another aspect I address in my paper is how there's been kind of a separation in many cities between those who are in local economic development and are really thinking about what sectors to attract, what kind of businesses to attract, what kind of infrastructure and redevelopment needs to take place to create new business clusters. And those who have been focused in on resilience and sustainability matters. And I did some work with the city of St. Louis when they were preparing their new economic development strategy. Now, St. Louis has got large pockets that are disinvested. It's one of those classic deindustrialized cities. But they've also been a center for the aerospace industry, and they're a commercial airplane hub. They've got a great startup community. But they're developing a new strategy. And I said, what we need to do now is figure out how to factor much more risk assessment in the context of analyzing what business sectors they would have locational advantages for. So at RCC, we've developed a whole set of ways that within the standard way that local economic development strategies are prepared, you can do that kind of risk and vulnerability assessment so that you can target your resources to sectors that are less vulnerable to the things that Vancouver would be exposed to, which is quite different than the things that Southern California is exposed to, say, with wildfires aren't your problem in Vancouver. You've got another threat, which I don't even want to mention, but it's the big one. We actually did mention it earlier, didn't we? Kind of sideways.
I don't know if I can take even talking about any
crisis. Yeah, no, I don't think anyone can talk about it. But, you know, so I think economic development strategy is more about the 10 to 20 year time frame of how you're going to build an economy that is more stable. You know, one sector goes down, but there's still enough economic life. Tourism is one of those that's highly vulnerable. It's quite clear. And Vancouver has been able to thrive quite well on that, as have many other cities around the world. But I think there's going to be a bit of a reset from that. The port is a very important part of the city, and understanding what the vulnerabilities of the port are as it continues to develop and capture more market share on the Pacific coast of North America. So how is resilience being factored into these things from a point of view of global economic resilience, not just from a point of view of seismic risk and things like that, is going to be really important. So that's changing the way that local economic development people will think as well. And while I'm at it, a discussion I just came out of, we were talking this through. It's expected that this summer is going to be one of the hottest summers in the history of the planet, recorded history of the planet again. We work a lot with the counties in Southern California that have had wildfires in the last two seasons. So there's a great concern that on top and perhaps even during COVID-19's second lap, there will be a wildfire season and many displaced people. And now what do you do with displaced people who have to be sheltered together when there's a pandemic going on? In other parts of the country, we work with Tampa, Florida. There could be a very strong hurricane season. So we really now have to start thinking through multiple shocks at the same time. And of course, we're not ready for them any more than we're ready for this one. But all the more reason, I argue, that every dollar that's now flowing into some kind of recovery effort has to also be leveraged in a way that it builds a longer term resilience. It can't just minimize the immediate shock that's happened. It has to think about how to buffer against all those cascading impacts and how they interact with other things that may come our way. And there's no easy answer to that. It's an exercise now everyone has to go through. And to your question about whether the recovery funds are yet enough, let's hold off and see whether the dollar amount is sufficient. But what is clearly not sufficient is that we're just thinking dollars. We're not thinking about how to leverage those for multiple benefits. And that's what we were working with the City of Vancouver on, with the Chief Resilience Officer there. Working under the city manager, is this is now specifically the city, not Metro, of course, but really to begin to understand what are the interdependencies and interactions between all these things. So my guess is there's something in the city's resilience strategy that can be, it hasn't been published for long, so it doesn't need to be too dusted off, but there are things there, there's groundwork already that's been made that can be built upon as you think about that recovery process.
Jeb, are you optimistic that we can learn these lessons quick enough, given the shocks that we've had and the shocks coming up? I mean, are you an optimistic person, knowing what you know about the resilience?
Well, for me, optimism is there's a scientific answer to that question, or an objective answer to that question, and then there's a personal mission-oriented answer to that question. I think the only good way to live is to wake up in the morning optimistic that there's something more that can be done today that will improve the situation or contribute to the improvement of the situation. And to not start the day that way is to, you know, undermine one's professional success and personal happiness. Scientifically, I think I've been saying even to my sons, this is dress rehearsal. The global financial crisis was dress rehearsal. Hurricane Sandy, I worked in Puerto Rico on the recovery strategy for Puerto Rico after Maria. Those storms are dress rehearsals. This is a dress rehearsal event regarding global health challenges. And so there is an urgency to building this infrastructure I've been referring to that is both social and economic. Because as in particular, climate change accelerates. And I'll go back to what I said earlier about the last five decades of the 20th century and the first of this one. To have an economy within a world where there's tremendous environmental stability, all of your resources are predictable to you, and weather is predictable to you, fire risk, pestilence is predictable to you. These things are now becoming unpredictable in ways. We don't even know how fast climate change is going to accelerate and impact agriculture in this country. And you've seen it in the forest industry in British Columbia, how much the ability of just one pest to reproduce one more cycle within a season, how big an impact that has on the industry. So we're just beginning to see the disruptive impacts of a destabilization of global climate and all of the environmental repercussions from that. So scientifically, it's hard to be optimistic that we aren't going to be an extremely destabilized society in the years to come. But let's be optimistic. You know, back to my opening point, you know, the culture of Canada, even the politics of Canada, of all things, has shown a resilience to sort of stay focused in on what the challenge is, come up with solutions, move things forward, learn from what's working, what's not working, and that keep putting the appropriate measures in place. But that has to happen at the federal level, at the provincial level, and at the local level, and at the neighborhood level. And so I keep coming back because it's been my career to focus at the local and the neighborhood level. We can't ignore that level of the infrastructure and the response.
Well, maybe we'll leave it there, Jeb, but on an optimistic note. And but we do have this segment called The Five Wire, which is five quick questions. Can you stick around for that?
Yeah, all right, shoot.
And you know Vancouver quite well?
I've been.
Didn't you say your son?
I've not lived in Vancouver, but I've worked with Metro and with the city, yeah.
Okay, and didn't you say your son went to UBC, I think?
Yeah, he started engineering at UBC, and then he's finishing up at U of T, but he's worked for a year at RDH, one of the great building science firms in the country and based in Vancouver.
Right. Yeah, we're very familiar with RDH.
I was saying the depreciation report company.
Yeah. Is that right? Yeah.
So first question is, what is your favorite neighborhood in Vancouver?
Oh, goodness. Stanley Park. when I'm in Vancouver, I'm typically staying downtown, and I beeline to your beautiful natural assets. That's what a lot of people do there, including a lot of Vancouverites. So let me leave it at that.
The second one might be a little bit more challenging, actually. It's favorite bar or restaurant. Presumably you're the type of guy who likes the local haunts.
I like a local craft beer. So I don't know if it's my favorite, and I'm not remembering the name, but the last time I was in Vancouver, I took the ferry. I commuted on the ferry over to North Van, and right at the ferry area, there's a cluster, a commercial space with lots of restaurants and things like that, and there's a craft brewery there. You'll have to fill in the blank on the name. But you know, what I love about Vancouver, and I can say the same thing about my neighborhood in Toronto, is that kind of craft production economy has come back up. And of course, it's favoring a certain demographic that loves these things. But it's great to come to Vancouver. There's always a new one to explore.
Right? Do you have a favorite place in Toronto that you want to highlight?
I love living in our neighborhood in Toronto because just about everything that you want is within a 5 to 10 minute walk. There's a little craft brewery on the laneway in Toronto in an old industrial building called Left Field. And it's very casual. It's kind of a garage space, but it's just a great kind of neighborhood gathering place. We have a neighborhood group here called Monday Night Beer League that one of the neighbors has organized. And so every other Monday night, we have a walking crowd that can go off within a short order to the Monday night craft.
That's a great idea.
To be drinking on Monday nights, but that's what Beer League is all about. So yeah, it's one of the pleasures here.
Is it a contest? No, it's actually
part of our it's with the intent of local money multiplier, like to get people together and get out on Monday night, which is a slow night, to support a local craft brewers and the restaurants that have associated
with. Right on.
And it gets us all out together. Actually, it's a great point on my whole argument, which in a less high-minded way. So what happens? Neighbors get together. We meet one another. I've met any number of neighbors that I didn't, you know, because there's always turnover. I have met before. We get to know one another. We get some exercise. We support a local business, and we create some social relations that, you know, get us through periods like this where we're all having cabin fever.
That's a great idea. Yeah. Question three, what is one book that you'd recommend to our listeners?
I'm reading this one right now. It's called Winners Take All: The Elite Charade of Changing the World. I have a work in progress, which is about what we've learned about social change in these times, particularly in disruptive times. And this book, which is a bestseller, really takes on the kind of co-optation of doing good in the world in a way that's really all about, you know, the well-off people feeling good about themselves. And it does a great critique of a lot of things, some things that I've been involved with myself. So I feel sometimes the critique goes a little bit overboard. But I think it's worth a read because we're living in a time, and particularly younger demographics have it wired into them that doing good in the world and living with purpose is part of a professional life, not just of a personal life. But it's very important that we're not just talking the language of change. Like, everything these days is revolutionary, everything's transformative, and it all sounds really great, but a book like this sort of makes us really take pause and understand what it takes to bring about the change that we would really like to affect. Now we're all going to get a big lesson in it because we have a crisis to recover from. So I think there's going to be a mobilization of people sort of really figuring out how to be relevant in a more grounded way in coming out of this crisis. That was only question three. There's two more.
Question four. These two, unfortunately, aren't quick ones either. But what is one piece of advice that you'd give your 18-year-old self?
My 18-year-old self, don't be 18 again.
It was a nightmare for you too.
Yeah, life has gotten better. Well, I have two sons. They're 20 and 22. So practically speaking, I guess I've kind of been I'm letting them absorb this and watching whether advice is needed. And what's interesting is I think they somehow, younger people, 18-year-olds, understand this is the world they're growing up in better than older people do. They don't have that reference point of those stable decades that I've referred to earlier. And so there's really something about being emotionally prepared for the world that you're living in that makes a difference about whether you're going to survive in it well. So I guess what I'd say to myself as an 18-year-old is get your therapy sessions done early so you can get on with life. How's that?
That is interesting, though, because when Greta was in Vancouver, they had all sorts of things on the CBC with interviewing teenagers about climate change. And that actually, what you just said reminds me of that I was struck by how they kind of come to have a kind of more accepting, or definitely more than I did, kind of like a realization, like, this is the world we live in, moving forward, it looks like this, in a way that, I still am having trouble getting my head around, but,
One thing that's really, I think exceedingly healthy, and I was the same as an 18-year-old, but, is the anger, is the space they're claiming to express. And she does it so well when she stands in front of the world's leaders at the United Nations. go ahead and express that anger because it's deserved, and it serves a positive purpose.
And final question.
Okay, we have a drum roll.
What is one thing that you've bought in the last year or two for under $1,000 that's had a positive impact on your life?
A second guitar, so that I'm not having. I'm into sort of folk music, and every now and then I'm playing Nick Drake songs now, and he has weird tunings, so that I don't have to retune my one guitar all the time.
That'll be our other
game changer. That's resilience. Like have a number of guitars, so you're ready to play a wide repertoire at any particular moment.
So Jim, how can people find out more about what you're doing and your research and, of course, Resilient Cities Catalyst?
Yeah, so Resilient Cities Catalyst, we have a website, of course, www.rcc.city, RCC standing for Resilient Cities Catalyst. Everything I'm writing these days is going there. I have a book, which I think is still very relevant. I actually did some analysis about the SARS pandemic in that book. It's called Welcome to the Urban Revolution, How Cities Are Changing the World. It's still available on Amazon. It's not available in my local bookstore any longer. That's too bad. And it's also available as an audiobook. So I think there's still a lot in that book for people who are wanting to learn about cities and the role that cities play in times of change like this, that is useful reading.
Well, fantastic. Thanks so much again for your time, Jeb. I think we went longer than I promised we would, for sure. But obviously, that was a phenomenal conversation. So we appreciate your time.
Thank you, Matt.
And
thank
insight.
Yeah, that's great. Good luck to you out there. I'll be paying attention to see what gets learned in Vancouver, and let's stay in touch.
Absolutely.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Jeb Brugman, founding principal of Resilient Cities Catalyst.
Really enjoyed that conversation with Jeb, Matt. And man, I got to say, like the dress rehearsal thing really sent me into a spiral.
You know what? Yeah, that was, I mean, there was some optimistic points there, but for the most part... you know what I took away from that more than anything else was support local business, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been thinking a lot about that. We've talked a little bit about it on the podcast, but resilient cities are grounded in local businesses. And I really like that point about, when I said, and just to get Jeb's thoughts on it, you know, when things cost a little bit more at your local store as opposed to at Costco or at Amazon or whatever, you know, how do you get around just the race to the bottom chasing prices? And I think he answered that perfectly, saying there's value. Mm-hmm. There's value in paying that extra. There's definitely some social value there. And it was, that was a phenomenal conversation. I learned a lot. And I think if we put some of that into place, I'm optimistic about the future of Vancouver.
You know what? This thing, this whole COVID-19 thing, if it's done anything for me, it's made me recognize how strong the community around us is. You and I both live in East Vancouver. I feel like some of the local businesses here are thriving right now. I spoke to a few people that own various businesses, one small local convenience store, and another was a microbrewery in town, and they're both super busy. They've seen an outpouring of support, people using their services. They've pivoted to delivery now, and they're just getting a ton of support from the community. So I'm so happy to see that, and I think Jeb is absolutely right. Some of my best memories of living in Vancouver are always kind of the mom and pop shops, you know, in my community or the locally owned restaurants. And let's continue to do our part.
Yeah, no kidding. It's absolutely the community is built around these businesses. And actually, now thinking about it, this idea that Jeb practices in Toronto, where a Monday night beer night at a local brewery seems like something that we ought to consider, maybe organize or at least thinking about in the future. Because that's
let's put it out.
I love that idea.
Let's put it out. I love that idea. East Van pub night. I really need a night out.
Yeah.
When all this ends.
Yeah. No.
Here, let's commit to it right now. When all this ends, let's do an East Van brewery night.
And you know what? Maybe we'll do it more than once a week.
We'll do it. We'll do it. Here's the thing. We'll do it 7 nights a week. No.
Set up an office.
No, no. But honestly,
we should think about that. I mean, honestly, we should really think about getting a bunch of people together and going out for a beer on a Monday night. That sounds like a fantastic idea right now.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, the last thing before we cut for the day, Matt. We are hiring at Scalina Real Estate. And so if you are an agent, so the real thing is you got to be licensed or you have to be almost licensed. You got to be in the process. Get in touch with us. We've got a fantastic opportunity. We are looking to take on an agent for the balance of the year and foreseeable future. So if you are interested, definitely get in touch. And Matt, how can people get in touch with you?
You can get in touch with me if you're interested in that opportunity or if you're interested in anything at all real estate related or otherwise, Resilient Cities or anything else. But you can give me a call at 778-847-2854 or matt@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
And before we get to that secret line, we should say as well, we haven't been plugging our website lately during the COVID, but the COVID crisis here. And I do want to say VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, that's where all the resources are. That's where all the back catalog is. There's a ton of information and resources and all things good over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. But we also got that secret line.
Yes, we do have that secret line. And if anyone has seen or heard of secret or has any idea on his whereabouts, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
We miss you, Secret, but we'll be back next Wednesday. We're moving back to the old schedule of one episode a week. We got a couple in the can here. They're very, very good. Very excited about that. So stay tuned. We'll be back next week and stay safe, everyone.
Yeah, Cameron McNeil next week.
It's a good one.
Take care.
2,000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.
Hey everyone, pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
This podcast is sponsored by Common Ground Consulting.
Are you developing in the Lower Mainland? Common Ground Consulting is a development management and consulting company with experience in single family, townhouses, multifamily, and commercial developments.
What I love about Common Ground, Adam, is they manage the whole development process, from due diligence and feasibility reports for initial purchase of land to completing rezoning, development permits, and building permits.
They streamline the whole process with strong relationships with sub-consultants and municipalities and a deep understanding of all city requirements.
Common Ground Consulting. Feasibility and efficiency prioritized every step of the way.
Learn more at commonground-consulting.com or 604-807-6419.
We are also sponsored by Oakwin Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakwin, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakwin.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.